As the Hollywood Ripper trial began to wrap up, the prosecution started to paint a picture of Gargiulo's guilt, his mindset before, during, and after the murders, and perhaps the most controversial piece of evidence that was introduced at the trial. One of the last witnesses to testify in Maria Bruno's case was Detective Troy Sella, a detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Fraud and Cybercrime High-Tech Crime Unit. On top of the DNA evidence relating to Maria Bruno's murder, there was also forensic evidence found on Michael Gargiulo's laptop, which was seized when he was arrested. Detective Sella testified that after conducting a forensic examination of the laptop, he found three instances where Maria Bruno's name appeared: a Google search, a Google image search, and an article from crimelaboratory.com with the headlines, "Modern Day Jack the Ripper Kills Former Model Maria Bruno in California." None of the other victims' names were found on the computer. But notably, Gargiulo also had a program called Trax Eraser Pro, which was designed to delete internet cache, search history, and other information stored on a computer. Sella testified that the program was configured to run every time the computer was shut down. As we touched on in Episode 4, Detective Mark Lilienfeld of L.A. County Sheriff's Department investigated Bruno's murder. During Lilienfeld's testimony, he detailed the crime scene as well as Irving Bruno's cooperation with the investigation. Lilienfeld also spoke about the search for Gargiulo's two work vans. Police had a warrant to search the vans, but eventually found them in Palmdale, a few miles from where Michael lived, emptied and abandoned. The writing on the side of the van reading "Gus the Plumber, Plumbing and Heating" had been removed from them. Both vans matched the license plates of two parking citations that were at Michael Gargiulo's apartment when it was searched. Lilienfeld also conducted the Perkins operation while Gargiulo was being held in El Monte Jail after he was arrested for the attack of Michelle Murphy. The operation wound up being one of the most controversial aspects of the trial. While being held in jail, two deputies with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department were placed into the jail cell with Gargiulo. They had recording devices in the cell. The purpose was to try to elicit statements from Gargiulo regarding the Ellerin or Bruno murders. Gargiulo would speak with detectives before being put back in the cell. During those conversations, Lilienfeld and Detective Tom Small would give him false information about evidence they had on him. Gargiulo was told police had DNA evidence linking him to Bruno's murder and that an eyewitness saw Gargiulo going into her home the night she was murdered. When Gargiulo went back to his cell, one of the undercover detectives, Dana Duncan, spoke with him for over 42 hours. Among Gargiulo's recorded admissions were that he knew both Ellerin and Bruno, talking about how he met Ellerin when she was having car trouble. He also talked about being in Maria Bruno's apartment multiple times and looking into her window once, which is the same story her neighbor, Robert Rasmussen, told. On two occasions, Gargiulo seemed to reenact knife attacks with intimate details about both murders. When speaking about the El Monte case, he shed doubt on the idea that the killer could be left-handed. After flushing the toilet to drown out the audio, he stood behind Detective Duncan and demonstrated with downward and upward stabbing motions, attempting to show that a right-handed or left-handed killer would leave the same marks in a body and that you could not tell the angle of the stab wounds. Detective Duncan testified that at one point Gargiulo walked from wall to wall with one hand out ahead of him and reached out with one hand as if he was grabbing someone around the face, pulling it to the side, With the other hand, he made circular slicing motions around what would be the victim's neck area. On top of the details about both murders, Gargiulo also tried to hatch an escape plan with both undercover detectives. He asked Detective Duncan to stand on his shoulders as he looked out the window to get a visual of the parking lot, the location, and how many police cars were in the area. He also crafted two handcuff shims out of a plastic spoon and talked about his plan to disable the jailer with a throat punch to escape. Eventually, the Perkins operation was terminated because the detectives feared someone might get hurt during Gargiulo's escape attempt. The defense argued the Perkins operation was a deceptive and manipulative police tactic, saying that trying to get him to confess to the murders was subterfuge. The next stage of witnesses focused on Gargiulo's past and specifically his mental state, with neuropsychologist Deborah Buddings testifying for the defense. Buddings testified that Gargiulo was in special education for most primary school due to behavioral issues, adding that he had a tendency to be angry and engage in power struggles with adults. Another defense witness, psychologist Dr. Vian Castellano, diagnosed Gargiulo with dissociative identity disorder, meaning he had multiple personalities. Let's bring back Joshua Ritter, criminal defense attorney and former Los Angeles County deputy district attorney. Josh, how could that diagnosis impact his ability to be charged or to receive the death penalty?
The defense was trying to use this to attack the intent element of premeditated murder. Premeditated murder, every murder, has two sides to it. There's the mental state, the mens rea, and then there's the act itself. Because many times, murders take place, but the mental state is what dictates what degree of murder that can be. You know, we see things like manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, second degree murder. Those all have to do with varying degrees of intent. In premeditated murder, you have to show that there was malice aforethought, meaning that they planned this, they intended to commit this murder. It was premeditated. And so by the defense entering these evidence and elements of his psychological state, they were attempting to cut away at that mens rea, that mental state, and say he was suffering from these psychological mental disorders and therefore couldn't form that proper intent, that premeditation for first degree murder. It also, I think, had an intended role for the defense on trying to chip away at a possible death penalty verdict here, because jurors may believe that a person committed premeditated first degree murder, but if they also believe some of this mental state mitigating evidence, they might not want to hold that person responsible for the ultimate penalty that we have in this country. In other words, they might say, we believe you're guilty of murder. We don't believe that you were insane. We don't believe that you were suffering from some sort of mental defect or disease that didn't allow you to form the proper mens rea to commit this crime. But we also believe that you were perhaps disturbed enough that we don't believe that you should suffer the death penalty. That could have been the twofold reason for the defense bringing this evidence into the trial.
Castellano also interviewed Gargiulo's family members ahead of the trial, who told her he suffered from severe childhood trauma at the hands of his parents and siblings from a young age. According to Castellano, Gargiulo's family members said he would be tied up and left in a closet without food or water for up to 3 days until he was about 8 years old. She also told a story of Gargiulo's mother and older brother punishing him by holding his hands over a gas stove. His siblings told her when Gargiulo was about 10 to 12, they would tie him to a tree and force him to watch his older brother place fireworks into a small animal and blow them up, knowing he was passionate about animals. Around age 13, an older brother would tie him to a chair and force him to watch videos of violent sexual behavior towards women. Castellano also noted there was a history of mental illness in Gargiulo's family. His father and siblings told her an aunt and uncle on both sides of his family had been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and his siblings had also been diagnosed with mental illness and admitted to psychiatric facilities. To support the findings of the doctors and psychological experts, the prosecution spoke to other witnesses from Gargiulo's past, including emotional testimony from two of his ex-girlfriends. One of them dated Gargiulo between 2005 and 2006 while he was living in El Monte. They had been seeing each other for 6 months, but Gargiulo would never let her meet his family. She testified that on one occasion the two got into an argument over his reluctance to let her meet any of his family. She accused him of being in another relationship. According to her, Gargiulo became angry, then raped her in the back of the van while she pled for him to stop. He eventually did stop and drove her back home, but she said Gargiulo threatened to kill her and her family if she told anyone. Another of Gargiulo's ex-girlfriend testified that Gargiulo would tell her how he could get away with murder because he studied forensic science and knew how to get rid of fingerprints. Another witness, Ashley Green, who lived in the same apartment complex as Gargiulo in Los Angeles, testified that Gargiulo once knocked on her door and asked if she knew how to defend herself if someone held a knife to her. Then he pulled out a pocket knife, told her to open it, and held it to her throat from behind. She said the phone rang and Gargiulo left, telling her, "I see you're busy." The final witnesses were focused on the mental health evaluation from psychologist Dr. Castellano and debates over the diagnosis that Gargiulo suffered from dissociative identity disorder, as well as the prosecution's own psychology expert, Dr. Robert Shug. After a 3-month criminal trial, the case finally moved on to closing arguments. In closing arguments, prosecutor Garrett Dameron told jurors to focus on the common characteristics of the attacks on Trisha Picaccio, Ashley Ellerin, Maria Bruno, and Michelle Murphy. He said Gargiulo had the mind of a serial killer, noting the eerie similarities between each of the attacks. Dameron said a killer is human who makes mistakes and leaves his signature on the murder he commits. Dameron focused on Gargiulo's attraction to each of the women, how he told a coworker that Michelle Murphy was hot and that he was going to get with her, that he was fixated on Ashley Ellerin at a party, how one of Gargiulo's neighbors, Brenton Dolson, said Gargiulo had spoken to him about Maria Bruno, saying, "That's how I like him, thin with large breast." He also pointed to Gargiulo's proximity to the victims and knowledge of the neighborhood, as well as his knowledge of each of the women's home, having been inside 3 of them, as well as a vantage point to see into Michelle Murphy and Maria Bruno's window. Dameron argued this allowed Gargiulo to plan his attack, entries and exit, and how to remain undetected. Dameron also talked about Gargiulo's strength and athleticism, arguing the killer in these cases had to be capable of committing such brutal stabbings. He detailed how Gargiulo was evidence-conscious, studying forensic serial killers and asking during his jailhouse interview if police could check the dumps for evidence that was thrown away, even attempting to escape, which showed a level of guilt. Defense attorney Dale Rubin said Gargiulo may have been in a fugue state and didn't know where he was when he was in Murphy's apartment. The defense team denied Gargiulo was responsible for the murders of Ashley Ellerin and Maria Bruno, arguing there were others who had more reason to murder both women and telling the jury they should find Gargiulo not guilty if the evidence had been established that some other person other than the defendant may have been involved in the killings. Defense attorney Daniel Nardoni focused on the lack of physical evidence tying Gargiulo to either crime scene and no eyewitnesses who saw him enter or leave either location on the night of the murders. Nardoni pointed the finger of Ellerin's murder to her apartment manager, Mark Durbin, who he said had sex with Ashley before she was murdered and also had a key to her apartment. Nardoni added that Durbin was still in Ashley's apartment when she took a shower and also when she took a phone call at 8:24 p.m. from Ashton Kutcher. He argued Durbin was also still in the apartment when the neighbor Todd Jackson heard two screams while he was walking his dog across the street around 8:30 p.m. He also suggests it was the estranged husband of Maria Bruno, Irving Bruno, who killed her in the El Monte apartment. Nardoni painted the picture of an abusive marriage, noting Maria had left her husband and moved out on her own into an El Monte apartment where she told the manager that she was concerned and in fear of her husband. He also noted that Maria's blood was found in Irving's car and that the gruesome nature of her murder was personal. Perhaps the most shocking omission in closing arguments came from Gargiulo's lead attorney, Dale Rubin, who admitted that the attack on Michelle Murphy was the only count where the prosecution showed Michael Gargiulo was in her apartment and attacked her. Nardoni called the attack on Murphy the elephant in the courtroom, admitting the evidence was much stronger in the Murphy case, but pleading with jurors to judge each case separately. There was three phases, guilt, sanity, and sentencing. After 4 days of deliberations, the jury reached a verdict. Michael Gargiulo was found guilty of first-degree murder in the killing of 22-year-old Ashley Ellerin in her Hollywood home. He was found guilty of murdering 32-year-old Maria Bruno in her El Monte apartment. Additionally, the jury found Gargiulo guilty in the attempted murder of 26-year-old Michelle Murphy in her Santa Monica apartment. Gargiulo was also found guilty of attempting to escape from jail after his arrest. Both murder charges include special circumstance allegations of multiple murders and a murder while lying in wait. Let's bring back criminal defense attorney Joshua Ritter. Josh, can you explain how lying in wait impact a murder charge and what special circumstances entails?
When you hear about a murder being death penalty eligible, what they're really talking about and the way that the law refers to it is as a special circumstance murder. And what that is referring to is that there are, in California, are several enumerated and outlined special circumstances that can enhance a murder from a first degree murder to a death penalty eligible murder. These are things like multiple murder. So a person who commits, more than one murder on one incident or has now been arrested for having killed several different people. Murder by torture. Another one is lying in wait. And what lying in wait really means is that beyond premeditation, beyond the planning of it, this person actually went about hiding and waiting to trap that person. And the law adds a special significance to that in the sense that it does show an even more culpable mens rea, an even more culpable mindset that, yes, you thought about killing this person. Yes, perhaps there was planning, but your planning went to the point of actually lying in wait for this person. And when those special circumstances, which have to be proven by the prosecution, they essentially become another element of the crime. If they are proven to a jury and the jury finds those special circumstances to be true, that makes the case eligible for the death penalty. Now, it's also a decision made beforehand by the prosecution whether or not they will even seek death. But even in a case where they are not seeking the death penalty, if special circumstances are attached and proved, that means that that person will automatically be sentenced to life without parole. And so it really ups the stakes, as it were, when it comes to a murder case where, yes, in many cases, you're looking at 25 to life, sometimes more. Now you're talking about life without the possibility of parole, or even possibly if the prosecution seeks to pursue that penalty, the death penalty.
After delivering the verdict of Gargiulo's guilt, the jury was now tasked with determining whether Gargiulo was sane at the time of the crimes. The defense relied on the testimony of psychologist Dr. Castellano and her diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder. Attorney Dale Rubin said when Gargiulo was attacking Michelle Murphy, he cut himself and suddenly he came to with no idea where he was or what he was doing, because he was in a dissociative state, adding he was a little kid back fighting monsters in his family home. Assistant District Attorney Garrett Dameron criticized Dr. Castellano's diagnosis of Gargiulo, saying she was bought and paid for after being paid $300,000 by the defense for her services. Dr. Shug, who testified for the prosecution, was paid just $1,500 for his testimony. He completely disagreed with Dr. Castellano's diagnosis, finding the only thing Gargiulo suffered from was anti-personality disorder. Dameron said that would actually enhance his ability to commit crimes. He said Gargiulo is not the victim. He is the victimizer. It took the jury 2 days to come to a decision. Judge Fidler asked 12 jurors if they believe Gargiulo was sane when he committed 2 first-degree murders and 1 attempted murder. All answered, yes. That left one more question to be answered. Convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of attempted murder, and attempting to escape from jail, and with special circumstance allegations of lying in wait and committing multiple murders, Gargiulo was facing a possible death sentence. For the penalty phase, witnesses included members of the Picaccio family, Ashley Ellerin's parents, Mike and Cynthia, Irving Bruno, and 3 of Gargiulo's ex-girlfriends. Michelle Murphy also spoke, as well as her husband. For the defense, Dr. Castellano made another appearance, and the only member of Gargiulo's family to speak at the trial, his son, Andrew Gargiulo. Doug Picaccio, Trisha's younger brother, testified his memory of finding his sister dead remained as fresh as it was at that time. He said, it almost gets to the point where you feel like the reality of the situation is a bad dream. And then you wake up and you relive the crushing despair that takes over you. And it took over me that morning when I saw her and I realized she was completely lifeless and there was essentially nothing I could do to help her. Every year of my life, I remember it like it was yesterday. Ellerin's mother and other victims' family members also testified during the penalty phase. When she learned about the death of her daughter, Cynthia Ellerin said, "I fell to my knees on the floor and started crawling around the bedroom on my hands and knees like an animal screaming." Mike Ellerin talked about having to give the news to his wife. He said, "The primal scream. I will never stop hearing that." Let's bring in Tom Small, retired LAPD homicide detective who investigated Ashley's murder. Tom, you had close contact with the Ellerin family over the years, even to this day. What kind of impact did it have on them?
Well, as you might guess, that when something this shocking happens, the shock and the trauma and the anger set in, and a lot of times the detective will catch the brunt of it because you're trying to work the case, but you're getting a lot of blowback and stuff from the family because they want to know what you're doing and where you're at and all this stuff. But over the years, I was able to forge a very close relationship with the Ellerins. In fact, now I would say we're actually pretty good friends. I still have contact with them pretty routinely. And in fact, I speak with the Picachos from time to time. But the Ellerin family, they, to this day, I mean, we can talk about anything in life and what's going on in their daily this and that, and they talk about my family and stuff, but it always comes back to the loss of Ashley, and they are traumatized to this day as if they just found the news out from 20 years ago. And it's really sad, the damage that a guy like Gargiulo does to everybody involved. And I mean everybody, friends, family in particular, even the detectives and officers that have to deal with this stuff, there's an indelible mark and it stays with you. The Ellerins have, they've carried on with their lives, but it's not the same. It'll never be the same for them. It's a deep, deep hole in their hearts. I believe they still have Ashley's ashes in a place at their home. I've been to their home several times, and they keep, I wouldn't call it an altar, but it's like a place of respect where they have Ashley. She's still with them. But it's deeply hurtful. But we were able to get through the traumatic episode of it, and now have forged a bond of some type. Her brother, Seth, younger brother, he really took it bad. I mean, it impacted his life adversely for several years. He's back in the fold. He's back at home as far as I think he's still at home. And he was living out of state at one point. But it has severely impacted him and Cynthia and Mike Ellerin. They're really, I treat them like they're my family, and they treat me the same way. There's a real deep respect. I guess it's from the common trauma of the whole circumstance. But I try to help them when they have those bad times. More and more often, it's a little more light. but they have their days when it just hits them hard. And if they call me or I call them on that particular day, I can tell right away. So, but it's deeply hurtful, as you can imagine. I mean, it's not something that the normal everyday family or person would ever experience. And to have that happen to somebody in your family, your daughter, your only daughter, that's a hit. So that's what I can say there is we've kept a bond, and I always hold them pretty close to the heart, and I know it's mutual.
I can never imagine how horrible it must be for that family to lose their only daughter and to have so much pain inside, to have a beautiful daughter that had such a bright future to be taken away by someone. And due to her involvement with celebrities, there was a lot of press stories about her and the family having to deal with that, not only deal with the press because of it, but then also deal with the fact that they've lost their daughter. And Ashley was linked to Ashton Kutcher, which put the story into the Hollywood tabloids because of his fame. A lot was made about their relationship and how she was seeing multiple men at the time, and if that was the reason for her to be murdered. Her parents had to deal with the murder of their daughter as well as all that. Gargiulo's 16-year-old son also took the stand, asking jurors for mercy and telling them he needs a father who is alive. In the end, the jury reached a decision in less than 5 hours. On October 18, 2019, the panel recommended Gargiulo be given the death penalty. Judge Larry Fidler ordered Gargiulo to return for formal sentencing on February 28th, but procedural delays on top of the emergence of COVID-19 caused a lengthy break in the trial. Finally, over a year later, on July 16, 2021, Judge Fidler sentenced Gargiulo to death for the murders of Ellerin and Bruno. He also gave Gargiulo a life sentence for the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. The judge called Gargiulo's crimes vicious and frightening, adding that everywhere Gargiulo goes, death and destruction follow. Gargiulo, now 45, had a shaved head with handcuffs and wore orange LA County jail overalls and a blue mask. He showed no reaction when the decision was read. Against his attorney's advice, Gargiulo asked to address the court, telling the judge he's been denied his fundamental right to testify. Judge Fidler reminded Gargiulo that he waived the right to testify at trial, but Gargiulo claimed that he wanted to testify, but his attorneys wouldn't let him, maintaining his innocence and claiming he was framed by tunnel vision detectives. Judge Fidler also denied the defense motion for a new trial, noting that the jury had rejected Gargiulo's insanity plea and his attorney's claim that somebody else killed the two women. The defense asked for mercy, arguing Gargiulo was mentally ill and pointing out California has a moratorium on executions, with the last person to be executed in 2006. Josh, can you explain the current state of capital punishment in California, and why hasn't anyone facing the death penalty been executed since 2006?
Well, first of all, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, has essentially put a moratorium on the death penalty. Interestingly enough, different propositions have come before the voters of California more than once, asking to essentially recall the death penalty and not make it available in California. And each time that's been done, the voters have said that they want the death penalty on the books. They want that to be part of the criminal justice system in California. The governor, however, has decided to essentially ignore all that and put a moratorium on the death penalty, meaning that no case that even has a capital punishment verdict, no actual executions are being carried out. But aside from kind of the politics of all of this, there's also an incredible backlog when it comes to death penalty cases. Every case where there has been a capital punishment death penalty verdict is automatically guaranteed an appeal to the Supreme Court of California. So you can imagine how this creates a type of bottlenecking effect where each one of these cases has to be assigned an attorney. Sometimes getting assigned that attorney can take years. The attorneys then need time to review all of that. That can also take a tremendous amount of time. There's the briefing back and forth. And then to ever even have that appeal heard by the Supreme Court in California can take a tremendous amount of time too. So you're talking years and years and years before these appeals are even heard. And then if they are heard, perhaps sometimes there are problems with the trial. These trials are addressed with incredible scrutiny, and they take a long look at everything that took place during the trial. And if there are issues, sometimes that needs to be re-litigated, sometimes that needs to be rebriefed, and sometimes that even could lead to a hearing back in court. So just the nature of going from the conviction itself to the actual execution of the punishment can take a tremendous amount of time, which leads to delays, which is why you don't, even when things are running normally, see these executions taking place with any kind of alacrity.
Josh, what lessons do you get out of this case?
This case, I think, is a really good example of one, the use of prior bad acts evidence, but also how that same type of argument can be applied to charged crimes and multiple charged crimes when you're trying to essentially have the crimes cross-corroborate each other. And what I mean by that is that you can, in each crime, highlight the similarities, how this person was obsessive, how he watched these victims, how he lived close to these victims, how in many cases he tried to befriend them, how they were all similar victims and that they were attractive young women, the actual execution of the murder, how it was overkill to some extent, the brutality of it, the psychological aspect of how these crimes seem to be for a purpose beyond actually killing someone, that there was just so much carnage involved in all of it. All of that can be evidence that you can say, listen, look at these similarities. And if you're having difficulty with one crime, you can notice how that crime is similar to another charged murder. And if you believe that that charged murder is stronger to connect to the defendant, you can allow those crimes to cross-corroborate each other and show, well, listen, we may not be able to tie him as strongly to murder B as we are to murder A, but the similarities between murder A and murder B and the attack where the young lady miraculously survived are so similar that we can believe it was the same person who committed all of these, and you can use that evidence in those separate murders to corroborate the other murders. And so I thought this case was an excellent example of that because they were so remarkably similar. And the prosecution did such a great job of pointing that out, how beyond the forensic physical evidence, the DNA and blood tying him to all of this, just the actual way these crimes were committed, the way that he pursued these victims and the victims themselves all show that this was likely, beyond a reasonable doubt, the same person who committed these murders.
With a California case now adjudicated, Gargiulo's next battle will be in Illinois, where he faces charges for the 1993 death of Tricia Boccaccio. He's still in California, awaiting extradition to Cook County before the new trial can begin. He continues to be innocent until proven guilty of Boccaccio's murder. Josh, what is the purpose of extraditing Gargiulo to Chicago to face charges for Tricia Boccaccio's murder if he's already been found guilty and sentenced to death in California?
Obviously, there's the concerns about the family wanting to bring justice for them. There's the more broad concerns about the prosecutors representing the people of their state and wanting to make sure that justice is done for the people of their state. A crime was committed in Illinois. They want someone to answer for that. But there's also the idea of just making sure that nothing slips through the cracks. I mean, God forbid Illinois were to not secure a conviction on this case, and for whatever reason, on appeal, his conviction falls apart in California. They want to make sure that there's some redundancy there and some protection from all of that. And you see this happen all the time, where someone is convicted and facing decades in prison in one jurisdiction, and they will extradite him across the country to face very similar charges for perhaps even less time in another jurisdiction. But putting aside all of the reasons of justice and the concerns of the victims, they also want to make sure that they have a backup plan in case things fall apart on appeal.
Back to Maureen Maher, former correspondent for 48 Hours, which helped crack the Boccaccio case open. Maureen, what stood out to you about the trial as we look ahead to the Cook County case?
I think the thing that stood out to me the most about that trial and continues to, I am in awe by how many people it took to get this guy convicted. When there was evidence, it took so many people to get this guy convicted. You had to have each one of the cases presented. You had to have each jurisdiction working together. You had to have friends and witnesses and families and communication and people who would never normally talk to each other, who would have no reason to be in touch with each other, different police departments, family members working together, family members across the country supporting each other, a young woman who survived. Like, it was just a Herculean effort to get this guy convicted. And all along, he was puppeteering a system that was set up to allow him to manipulate it. And he's continuing to do it today. And it's not just him, it's the system. There is no one person to blame other than Gargiulo for the heinous acts that he's committed. But the manipulation and the system faltering as a result, the fact that it took 11 years to get him to court, Gargiulo was in LA County Jail longer than any other inmate awaiting trial in the history of that county jail, like back since the 1920s. And it took so long to get him there. And then we had the pandemic, and then it took longer to get the sentencing. It just continues to blow my mind a number of people it is taking to get this guy convicted of crimes that we now know for sure he's been convicted of committing, and what he has been charged with the killing of Trisha. And I've never seen a court case, cases take the amount of effort it has taken, and the commitment of every single person along the way, the families, the cops, the prosecutors, the friends, the commitment to stay with it, and unrelenting commitment to get it done. Including the reporters. I mean, not just myself, but you have a handful of reporters who've also been on it from the beginning, who have also not let it go. And that's what it's going to take to get him back here in Illinois and get him on trial here for the Picaccios. Then that's what it takes. Murder is murder, and the way each one of these women were taken from the world, and you know, miraculously that Michelle Murphy survived, it's hard to imagine one human could perpetrate this on another person. And of course, Ashley's friends had known Michael Gargiulo, and he'd been seen around Michelle's apartment and seen around Maria Bruna's apartment, but the Picaccios knew Michael Gargiulo. They had known him as a young boy growing up in that neighborhood. And I think it's just a different story for the Picaccios who knew him. He was in their house, and to have to sit here and wait this long, it was bad for everybody in this case and hard for everyone to wait. But I just think for the Picaccios, you know, Rick is a cancer survivor. This is a couple that's not getting any younger, and they now have grandchildren. It's just time for them. They want to face this kid who's not a kid anymore, but he was a kid in their neighborhood that they knew. They want to get this over and done with and to move forward. As Tommy said to me recently, like, it's not closure. There's no closure. And any murder victim's family will tell you there's no closure. But don't they deserve to at least get into court and find out what's going to happen?
Michelle Murphy and the Ellerin and Bruno families did eventually get justice, but they had to wait over a decade for it. As Mark Lilienfeld told us, detectives are also suspicious that Gargiulo may have committed as many as 10 other murders based on statements he made during recorded jailhouse interviews. As we look ahead to the Picaccio trial, there are some key questions for Cook County prosecutors to answer. The DNA evidence from Trisha Picaccio's fingernails, the way it was collected, and the casual contact theory will no doubt be a big part of the trial. We also heard about another suspect in the early stages of the investigation, before Gargiulo was even named as a suspect. Is it possible there could be another person who's to blame for Trisha's murder? Doug Longini told us the initial suspect's family had indicated they thought he was responsible for the murder, and Gargiulo himself was originally questioned about someone else's involvement. How much will be made of Cook County's original decision not to prosecute Gargiulo? And how will Gargiulo being found guilty of the California murders play into Trisha Picaccio's trial? California prosecutors use the prior bad act statute to help prove Gargiulo's guilt in multiple murders. Will Cook County be able to use similar tactics to prove Gargiulo killed Trisha Picaccio? We'll continue to follow the Gargiulo case headed into the Cook County trial, and hopefully Trisha Picaccio's family finally gets answers to the question they've been asking for the last 30 years since Trisha's death in 1993. Thank you for listening, and thanks to all our amazing guests: Doug Longini, Mark Mester, Joshua Ritter, Mark Lilienfeld, Daryl Lowe, Tom Small, Dr. Kristen Middleman, and Maureen Maher. Special thanks to Assistant Deputy LA County District Attorneys Dan Aikman and Garrett Dameron. I'm Kelly Hyman. And this has been Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper. If you like this podcast, please go to www.onceuponacrimeinhollywood.com and you can listen to our other podcast, Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Ronnie Chasen Story, which is a fascinating story about a PR person in Beverly Hills, California, who was murdered, and we walk you through the ins and outs of that murder. Also, please feel free to reach out to me on social media. You can catch me on Instagram, X, and TikTok. I look forward to connecting.